So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate.
I'm David.
Yeah. It's been 3 weeks, brother. We had an interruption.
We did.
In the output here. The schedule kind of fell apart because life got in the way.
Life happens.
Yeah.
And along with other things, as they say.
Yeah. So, by the way, how's your mom?
My mom is stable and home and doing well for someone who's about to be leaving us in a few weeks.
And she's in hospice care
and but she is she is receiving lots of guests, and I went to see her over the weekend, and there were 10 people in our house. Mom and Dad's house, and so I got to spend about 20 minutes with her because she's all her senior friends and neighbors and all are coming in to talk and share with her, and she,
how beautiful is
yeah,
that?
It really is. I mean, it is such a bittersweet time, but she has taken the opportunity to. She's taking the opportunity to tell each person that comes in to see her what they have meant to her.
Golly.
And
very
specifically.
That's beautiful.
It really is. It's a gift that she is taking great advantage of, mm-hmm. and doing this on her terms.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you asking. But yeah, it's been tough, but it's part of life is losing it.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Wow.
But yeah, thanks for asking. But you've had some ups and downs. Allie's come through her surgery.
Yep. So my wife had the old knee replacement surgery.
Right.
And as I think I told you the last time we had a recorded conversation here, we've had a few conversations since then that have not been recorded. But the last time we were like behind these mics, that they sent her home the very next day.
Yeah.
And yeah, I want to tell you, those first few days home were rough.
Yeah, no doubt.
I suppose I should have remembered from childbirth, although it's been a long time since Allie delivered our last child. But it came back to me. When a woman is in extreme pain, all of her filters are disabled.
So you learn what she really feels and thinks really fast, right?
I had no idea how much she holds back until she wasn't. Because she gave me some very, very direct feedback on, my nursing skills. And general capacity for empathy. And it was humbling, really, for me to face how dependent I am on approval. You know what I mean? I like helping people. I really do. I'm a helper. But apparently, I do it for the applause.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want a plaque. I want a People's Choice Award. I want some, at least an acknowledgement. Boy, when it's not there or when I get negative feedback.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing quite like making huge adjustments in your own life to accommodate something that somebody else didn't ask for.
Right.
And then you really not being... appreciated for your contribution because they are in pain. I almost asked you how your knee replacement was because last time we were on the podcast, you were debating on how many days it would actually be until you made it about you.
That's right. Well, I didn't make it about me. I lasted maybe 6-7 hours. Then it was all about me.
That's great.
You know, it's good. I mean, since then, she's making a remarkable recovery. She really is.
That's great.
3 weeks out now from the actual operation, and she's walking around the house without a walker or a cane.
Mm, good, good.
With some chemical assistance.
Well, yeah.
But she has apologized. She has a kind of a foggy recollection of some of the things that she said to me in those they're etched indelibly. I can recite them syllable for syllable.
Right.
And she's apologized for a couple of things she said that were not very diplomatic. but it's true. I'm a terrible nurse.
Well,
I'm unskilled for one thing.
Yes. Right? It's like a bit like being told that, you know, somebody's going to lock you in a room, and once the rocket is completed, you could come out.
Yeah.
Because I have no skills in rocket science. and I remember feeling the same way when Tricia was alive and needed care, you know, a constant care. I said, look, you've got a piano player for a nurse.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
So that's about, you know, if they didn't teach it in music school, then mm-hmm. I don't know how to help you here. So we're just winging it and all doing the best we can and having days where I don't want to be me and she doesn't want to be her. And when those days fall on the same day, it's not a good day. So
I'll tell you what, I am so grateful now, though, to be back in the rhythm of my normal life and schedule.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fact that I'm back seeing my friends, taking my walks with my guys in the early morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was really dependent on some technology, on making phone calls and virtual meetings with Samson, being able to actually connect with other people.
Right.
If it had just been she and I alone in a cabin in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no phone.
Right.
I don't know whether we would have survived.
Yeah.
I need some community.
Absolutely. And man, nothing brings out, I don't know, adversity doesn't really change your circumstances so much. It just reveals, I think, how we truly feel mm-hmm. about ourselves and our circumstances. It's not that it's the adversity that's so bad. It's just that it rips the sheets off of the ugly naked body, and we all have to look at it.
If this journey of recovery is a process of gaining clarity and getting honest with mm-hmm. ourselves, with mm-hmm. the world, then adversity is an invaluable tool. Right?
Mm, yeah.
We can't maintain our illusions for long when we bump up against real life.
Yeah.
I still do my very best to avoid a real life as much as possible because I like to maintain the comfort of my illusions.
Right. Well, yeah. And I heard somebody say recently, that part of that same kind of idea is that it's because we're groomed to believe that life is 90% happiness and 10% sad.
Right.
And anything that exceeds the 10% sad is somehow abnormal and we're going through some kind of, you know, persecution and all of that. When in fact, you know, a lot of life, most of life really has a bunch of sad and hard in it. And then you get these glimpses, you know. I told somebody I thought maybe if you added up the glimpses, maybe you get 3 good days out of 80 years. I don't know.
Oh,
there's I hope happy it's better than you.
Well, actually, this is a point that is going to be made a little bit by our guest.
Yeah.
Just to clue the listeners in, you did actually do the interview with our guest a couple of weeks ago.
I
wasn't able to make it.
Right.
But I have listened to the tape, and it's a wonderful conversation.
Well, thank you. Dr. Stephen Lloyd is an amazing resource, just personally and for He's the medical director of the Journey Pure Treatment Centers mm-hmm. throughout the country, but he's also involved in national and state level things here in Middle Tennessee, and just understands the complexities. You know, so our conversation covered everything from medically assisted recovery, which is a little controversial for mm-hmm, some, mm-hmm. to just some really vulnerable personal stories.
I love it that he's one of us and doesn't pretend to be otherwise.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So without belaboring that any further, why don't we go ahead, take a quick break, and then come back with our guest, Dr. Stephen Lloyd.
Sounds good.
Hang with us. We'll be back in a minute here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to this episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I'm David, and I'm here. Nate is not joining us today. He's got an issue at home. Allie needs a little bit of extra TLC right now, and so he's finding himself at home. But we've got a great guest today. It's Dr. Stephen Lloyd. And Stephen, you are the medical director for Journey Pure, for all the facilities of Journey Pure, as well as many other organizations, good organizations in the Nashville, Middle Tennessee area, and also you've worked with the State Department of Mental Health. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, welcome, but tell us a little bit about this multifaceted life. But I do want to let our fans know that besides being a medical doctor, you are also one of us.
Absolutely.
One of the family. And
that's the best thing about me.
And I've heard you speak a number of times and share just kind of how you got here. But tell us a little bit about your background, what you, how you found yourself in the situations where you were suddenly working with the addicted population.
David, it's funny. I was on the phone last night with a guy who's at the National Prayer Breakfast right now about some preventative things that are just mind-blowing and you know, utilizing technology. And I told him, as he asked me the same question, I feel a little bit like Forrest Gump because, you know, I'm 20 years out of medical school, and if you told me in medical school and residency that my passion in my career was going to be addiction medicine, I would have laughed. First of all, I wouldn't have known what addiction medicine was, and I certainly would not have seen myself there. And so I'm a trained internal medicine physician, hospitalist, working in the ICU, and have done that for a number of years. I've been a chief of medicine at a VA in my hometown of Johnson City, and been on faculty at the medical school I graduated from for really about the past 17 years. Mm-hmm. But 3 years deep into my training, as I was a chief resident, I discovered prescription pills, opioid pain medications, mm-hmm. Lortab, Percocet, and this was around 1999, 2000.
Yeah.
So right on the front wave of our current opioid crisis. And within just a matter of time, I was using about 500 milligrams a day. If you put that in Vicodin terms, that's 100 Vicodin pills a day.
Wow.
Yeah, not 100 milligrams, 100 pills. And,
wow.
And really, you know, reached a point that I just thought I would die in my sleep. I didn't know that there was anybody out there that could help me, and if I did ask for help, I was going to lose everything I had. And you know, turns out lucky for me, you know, being a physician, none of those things happened. I got quality help from, I guess, one of your guests here, Chip Dodd.
Yeah, just talked to Chip a couple of weeks ago.
Chip Dodd saved my life in 2004.
Wow.
And really, David changed everything about my life. I'd been in recovery for a few years after Chip helped me back in 04, and I was looking around at my patients, you know, who were struggling with this, because I wasn't doing addiction medicine, and you'll love this. I thought, you know, why can't these people do what I did? You know, I'm doing great. My career's going up, and you know, what's wrong with them?
Right.
And I literally sat straight up in my bed one night, and I looked over at my wife, and I said, well, how arrogant am I? Because I had 90 days of high quality treatment. I had 5 years of aftercare follow-up and accountability, and I had the leverage of a medical license. And it dawned on me that night that I had every single advantage, and the people that I was dealing with at the time had none of those.
Right.
And it was really an eye-opening experience for me. And so from that time, my love and understanding of addiction medicine has only grown. I tell people all the time, I'm a big sports guy. I don't read Sports Illustrated or watch ESPN anymore. This is what I do. And I can't believe I get to do it for a living. Because what I do now is I help people find the path to recovery that's right for them. And that's the best way to describe it. I really honestly meet people where they are. I never give up. Mm-hmm. I don't care how low the bottom is. You know, there's the old saying in NA, you know, jail's institution and death. And I always tell my parents, you know, the only time that I can't help is death. Mm-hmm. If it's a jail or institution, we got a chance, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
And I really believe that, and I live my life that way. And I've been practicing addiction medicine now for about 8 years. And I have, I'm a proponent of medication-assisted treatment, as you know, and mm-hmm. hopefully we'll get to explore that here in a little bit.
Yeah.
But as I've told you, and I say in all my talks, the opposite of addiction is not recovery. The opposite of addiction is connectivity and relationship community. Right. And so that's really the mission, is to help people find that community that supports their sobriety. And it's just taken me on a path that I never could imagine. I guess that my top priority and the thing that probably gets my juices flowing the most is the treatment of IV drug-dependent pregnant women. Mm. You think about that and you think, golly, you know, people think that's depressing. And I can tell you that the women that I take care of inspire me, motivate me, and I stand in awe of them mm-hmm. 99 out of every 100 days. Mm-hmm. And it's such a fun thing to get to do and watch a young woman turn her life around and watch a baby be brought into the world under much different circumstances than mm-hmm. it would otherwise happen. So that's, you know, that's my passion. Yeah. I'm involved in multiple other things besides Journey Pure. I call myself the assistant medical director, and I think that's probably my name at a facility here in Nashville called The Next Door.
Right.
And just a big fan of the work done by those folks.
And they are one of the only places that will accept pregnant women.
They are, and I help them with that. They have a doctor there who is a great guy named Michael Ferry, and Mike and I you know, help pregnant women there. And Cindy Sneed and the folks at The Next Door have been very open to that. Mm-hmm. And the nurse practitioners there, they're all women, and they're absolutely wonderful. You know, sometimes when I'm feeling down, I like to just go there.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And be inspired by the work that I see being done. And there's so many good people in the Middle Tennessee area that support The Next Door. And, you know, sometimes, David, I don't know about you, and I watch politics on a national scene, and I get pretty discouraged. And, mm-hmm. and all we ever see is the negativity. And I just see so much positivity out there every mm-hmm. single day. And it really keeps me going. And I think these are the stories that we need to trumpet, because we're talking about a middle ground here. This is not a red state, blue state thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a place that we can find common ground and to help each other.
Yeah.
I love this. You know, that there's not a single major religious text in the world that doesn't talk about loving your neighbor.
Right.
It's the one thing that I know is common amongst them all. And that's what you and I are here to talk about today. Mm-hmm. I guess some of the crazier aspects of my life, I serve as an expert witness in drug cases against physicians for improperly prescribing pain medication.
Okay.
And these aren't guys, you know, that are writing, you know, older patients a prescription for 30 Lortab. These are mm-hmm. doctors that are, you know, are actively selling prescriptions, trading prescriptions for sex and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I've done that for about 12 years.
Wow.
And the first time I ever was on the witness, I'd never been in a courtroom in my life.
Uh-huh.
And I was on the stand for 11 hours. It's nauseating to think about right now, but I really enjoy the work because I think we can make a difference. And I think that we can let people know that, you know, you're going to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. And you're not just providing a prescription. You could be feeding someone's addiction that rips the fabric of their family apart. And we don't need to stand for that.
Right.
And so I've done that for a long time. I've got 3 active cases right now ongoing, mm-hmm. and I've done 21 of those over the past 10 or 11 years.
Wow.
And so, as I said, I've been a pariah. I've, you know, been fortunate enough a few years ago, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which the head of that is the director, but he's affectionately known as our drug czar. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was a person that I love and respect, Mr. Michael Botticelli. And I was named an advocate for action by the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which is a office of the President of the United States.
Wow.
And so the day I got to go to Washington, we're going into the White House, and I was walking from the old executive office building across the driveway into the west wing of the White House, and I stopped and I looked around, and I was overwhelmed. At the time, I'd been in recovery for 10 years, and I went back to that moment of the shaking withdrawals, of the sweats, of the looking out my window at Vanderbilt, wondering if my life was over. And then I'm walking into the west wing of the White House.
Wow. That's about as inspiring and a picture of hope as I can imagine coming from that place.
It was. And I'm sorry right now. It was an emotional day.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember looking up at the top of the White House, and, you know, they have people with snipers up there, and I thought, man, they're not opening fire on me, which is good. And I was there by invitation, and we walked in, and we sat down at this big table, and I was, you know, was in the Roosevelt Room, and of course, I'd never been there and could never dreamed it. And in walked Mr. Botticelli, and it was his first day on the job.
Wow.
And his seat was right next to me. And as we're going around the room, the people are talking about how they got there, because I think there were seven other recipients.
Yeah.
And one of the guys, Judge Burns up in New York, was the founder of drug courts. He started the concept.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm sitting like, oh, my gosh. And then another person was head of the Joint Anti-Narco-Terrorism Unit of the Navy and was over, like, the Caribbean and Atlantic fleets. And I'm like, what am I doing here, right? I'm, you know, this is just cool. one of the other recipients had marched with Dr. King.
Wow.
And I'm sitting in this room, and I've just got this blank look on my face. And Mr. Botticelli, who I don't know and hasn't said a word to me, reaches over and he puts his arm around me. He leans over my ear and he said, hey, Doc, he said, have you ever wondered if you're in the right place? Now, keep in mind, David, I hadn't said a word to him. I'm just sitting there listening.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, yes. I said, right now. He said, me too, Steve. And he said, I'm the drug czar.
Wow.
And I relaxed. And it turns out, you know, as I got to know Michael over the next few years and still even today, he's in recovery himself.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, about 25 years from alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And he was our first drug czar in recovery. And so Michael was an inspiration to me that day. And, you know, I tell people that story because anything is possible. I'm not saying that everybody gets to go to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that is always impressed upon me when I talk about meeting people where they are is that, you know, if we can get you on a path and you engage in meaningful relationship and community, literally anything is possible.
Yeah.
Who would have dreamed that, you know, a boy that grew up and born and raised in Northeast Tennessee and rural Appalachia, you know, would sit at, you know, sit in the Roosevelt Room of the White House.
Yeah.
And what got me there was my addiction to prescription pills and alcohol.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk it?
Yeah. Yeah. What a concept.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're talking about even just the contrast between what you had known hitting the wall, so to speak, you know, looking out your window at Vanderbilt, wondering if life was ever going to look like you ever, anything you ever wanted to do again, you know, and then you're at the White House, you've been entrusted basically with a lot of not just responsibility but opportunities, and maybe to change a little bit about the way we as a culture think about addiction, think about treatment, think about what has worked, what hasn't, you know, do we need to tweak the sacred cow, the 12 steps, do we need to, you know, what are all these things that that we are looking at now, where science and medicine and culture and the steps all work together in connection and community for people. But how do we impact a culture that that still mischaracterizes, misunderstands, stigmatizes the addict as opposed to, you know, the war on the medicine?
That's a tough question, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of moving parts to that, and I'll start off by telling you that I'm an abstinence-based guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got great treatment from Chip at CPE back in the day, and you know, the wonderful aftercare and follow-up I've had provided by me by the Tennessee Medical Foundation here in Nashville has changed my life. Most people don't have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I told you about that epiphany moment of sitting up in my bed and taking a hard look at myself and the advantages I had. And we have to realize that most people don't have that opportunity. They can't take 3 months away from their life and get that kind of help. They don't have an advocacy foundation like the Tennessee Medical Foundation to help them in their job. Most people are in their lives. They have mm-hmm. families, they have jobs, and those things are might as well be a million miles away. And so I think that the thing that I want to do first and foremost every day is to get people to understand the importance of destigmatizing the disease of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the best treatment programs in the world, Michael. If nobody steps out and asks for help, it don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we have to do is we have to look at ourselves and say, are we open-minded enough to take a different approach to how we view this? And the view is not as a moral failure. And I always draw this parallel, and I think it's an appropriate one. And I've been drawing this parallel for a long time, and I love seeing some people in the mainstream media now start to draw the parallel. The opioid crisis is this generation's HIV disease and AIDS.
Yeah.
And I know you're old enough to remember this from the 80s and mm-hmm. when HIV disease and AIDS came on the scene and how it was stigmatized. And,
yeah.
you know, people wouldn't let their kids swim in a swimming pool, you
right.
know, and some things happened that started to destigmatize HIV disease. And it was a death sentence back then. And you had Ryan White, you know, mm-hmm. the kid who got it from a blood transfusion. And then you had, you know, some high profile celebrities that started to speak out. And I don't think you can ever underestimate the impact of Irvin Magic Johnson, you mm-hmm. know, in the early 1990s. And what we saw was HIV disease and AIDS become destigmatized. We saw better treatments available from as a result of some pretty militant organizations, but they got the job done, ACT mm-hmm. UP being the mm-hmm. one that comes to mind.
Right.
And you saw people start to destigmatize and not be judgmental. You saw people start to, you know, step out and ask for help early. And as they did that, the death rate from HIV disease and AIDS has plummeted. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, when's the last time you opened the newspaper and saw an article on it?
Mm-hmm.
It's not an issue. People live normal lives now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're looking at the same thing with regards to the opioid crisis, because we have effective medication, much like we did back in the day,
mm-hmm.
that has a 70% mortality benefit, which mm-hmm. is, try to find another drug that has it. I'll save you a little time. You won't.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, drugs, I'm talking about naltrexone, I'm talking about methadone, I'm talking about buprenorphine, and mm-hmm. that we all know as Suboxone.
Right.
We have effective medications that help people stay engaged in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a huge barrier to people stepping into these programs, and that barrier is that we have two warring factions out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have good people on both sides, and
mm-hmm.
you have the 12-step community that says recovery is defined this way, and I'm always interested in that because actually the 12 steps or AA or NA never define recovery. The first step says you have a desire to stop the behavior,
right?
Doesn't even say you have to stop. You have to have the desire.
Mm-hmm.
So the definition of recovery, I think, is something we need to look at. But you know, there's only one pathway, and for the people that are, you know, loyal to those groups, that pathway worked for them. Well, what if it doesn't work for somebody else?
Right.
And addiction is the only disease I know of that when someone fails the treatment that's recommended most often, it's their fault. So, right?
Exactly. Yes.
And then the other side of the street are the medication folks that says, well, you know, just put everybody on medication and they'll be fine. Well, I'll submit to you that you can do that and you can save a lot of lives. But if people don't change their behavior, their lives don't change.
Right.
And so I'm looking to step out, because what's caught in the middle of these two warring factions are patients and people struggling with addiction and families. And
mm-hmm.
and they don't know which way to turn. And I hope you'll indulge me this one story, because I mm-hmm. had this recently happen. I had a young guy who came into treatment. I'm reading his history, multiple overdoses,
mm-hmm.
David, and had been reversed multiple times with Narcan. He died, right?
Yeah.
And he's going to go through the same exact treatment process that he's already done four or five times.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned early in recovery that definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And
right.
I intervened. I went and talked to him, and I'm going to make up his name. We'll call him Michael. That's not his name. And
yeah.
I said, Michael, you know, my name's Stephen Lloyd, and here's what I see. And what I was advocating for was for him to look at a medication-assisted treatment to hold his cravings at bay until the frontal lobe of his brain could wake up and give him time to get insight and judgment and give him a better shot at long-term recovery while he engaged in this community-building treatment process.
Mm-hmm.
And his family was against it. Oh, you're trading one pill for another, and you know his girlfriend didn't want any part of it, and she had heard this about it or that about it, and so he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And last Wednesday night, I got a phone call,
mm-hmm.
and Michael was found dead.
Oh man!
And David, I'm tired of watching that.
Right.
And I think we in the recovery community have to ask ourselves the question, and the question is do we believe that there's only one path to recovery? And if we truly believe that, then I'm telling you that there's 85% of people who could get there won't ever get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not willing to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't want to alienate anybody on either side. And I promise you, I'm in a unique position because I get beat up from both sides.
Sure, yeah.
And recently, this is terrible, it shows you my ego, I compared myself to John McCain, you know, in on the national scene in politics. You know, where have the John McCains gone?
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like here.
You right.
know, I want to help people find the path. path to recovery that's best suited for them.
Yeah.
Outside of that, I don't care.
Yeah. Well, and so we have folks that are dealing with addiction. They're dealing with substances, and we can maybe even get them on medications, mm-hmm. that are helpful for sustained recovery. We can get them into one-on-one therapies that are great for getting to trauma and anxiety, all these things that are drivers and things. Where I feel like I lose the most people, and I don't mean lose them in the sense that we lost Michael, mm-hmm. but where I lose them in their willingness, where I run the most resistance, is when I bring up connection. Where are you going to know and be known? Where are you willing to go and engage? Because you've got to engage. You're not going to do this at home on your couch. I mean, the medicine's great. Go to therapy. That's great. Don't drink, don't use. That's great. But who's going to know you? And they're like, I can't do that. That's like asking them to crawl across broken glass for some reason. What do you think it is about us as human beings that connection is actually more scary to us sometimes than, or it seems to me anyway, that that's more frightening than some of the other aspects of recovery we ask people to participate in.
Your listeners, if they listen consistently, they've heard Chip mm-hmm. Dodd. And when I was in treatment, Chip taught me this. He said, Steve, what are the two things human beings have to have? And everybody, I guess, food, water, sex, right?
Yeah.
And he said, no, none of those. He said, they have to belong and they have to matter. It's innate. It's in us. We're mm-hmm. communal human beings. We got together in tribes and formed cities and towns and countries, right?
Yeah.
And it's in us. And if you don't believe that it's in us, what do we to punish people?
Mm-hmm.
We isolate them, right? Mm-hmm. You get in trouble, you go to jail, so we pull you out of the population. And what happens if you get in trouble in jail? We put you in solitary.
Right.
That's the ultimate form of punishment, is to isolate you. And I don't think it's a problem overall, David, that we resist it. I think it's unique to our disease process.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look back, and I'm sure that you've talked about this before, but the role that trauma plays in the development of addiction. And, we don't trust people. The people that we have trusted have violated our boundaries. They've abused us physically, sexually, and emotionally. They have listened to us, and we've been able to confess, but then they turn around and use that to manipulate us going into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just like that. I wasn't mm-hmm. going to rely on anybody, and I certainly wasn't going to open up. And that wasn't until I got into recovery, and I was actually sitting in Chip's office about 6 weeks deep in recovery, and I'd held on to my last secret. And my last secret at the time, and I've piled up secrets since then, and had to confess them. So don't think I don't have any anymore, because I'm still a work in progress. But I had stole medication, OxyContin, from a dying cancer patient,
mm-hmm.
and it was somebody who was really special to me. He was a teacher of mine in med school, and I was taking care of him at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just any patient, and I justified it because I could just write him some more, so it wasn't really stealing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You and I both know it was stealing. And that was the last secret that I held on to, and I went in Chip's office, and he sat down, and I told him that, because
mm-hmm.
I had started to have dreams about my friend, and he was looking at me, and he never said anything, but the quizzical look is why.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for me, he died before I could make an amends.
Mm.
And he would have been very supportive of my recovery. He was just that kind of guy, and I mm-hmm. love him very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Chip what I just told you, and Chip sat back in his seat, and he scanned my eyes and, back and forth, and he said, Steve, it's not okay. Right? He didn't pat me on the back. He didn't minimize it. He said, it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but I love you. God loves you. He forgives you. That was the first moment in my life I ever believed that. First
wow.
moment.
Wow.
And I've never forgot it. August 16th, 2004 was mm-hmm. the date. And everything for me changed on that day. I've known Chip for that long.
Mm-hmm.
He's never brought that back up to needle me.
Mm-hmm.
He's never brought that back up to remind me of what I'm capable of. He's been supportive. He doesn't always tell me things I want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned at that point that the person that I wanted to be in community with was not the person that put their hand on my shoulder and told me what a great guy I was.
Mm-hmm.
The person that I wanted to be around was the person that put their hand on my shoulder, looked me in the eye, and saw things that I can't see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a frightening prospect for all of us.
Right.
Because our experience has been, when we've trusted to somebody from that level, we've gotten killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you look at people with addictive disease, that's the scary prospect. And I'm going to admit something here. This is I'm a little bit embarrassed, but not really. I love Downton Abbey.
Right, oh,
the TV show, right?
I'm in.
I'm huge.
Absolutely. Right? And there's a movie coming, by the way.
I know. I can't wait. I can't wait. And tonight, me and my wife are watching the last episode. We have been buried in it, and there's so much wisdom in that show, and I'm amazed by the writers. But last night, one of the characters was scared to step into a relationship with a new man. She had lost her husband early in her life to a car wreck, and now her new beau was a race car driver, you know, mm-hmm. and now she's thinking about this, and she looks at her brother-in-law, and she says, I can't stand the thought of allowing myself to be vulnerable and risk that kind of pain in my life again. Mm-hmm. And he looks her straight in the eye and he said, that's what life is about. You will experience pain. And he said, that's what it's about. Chip Dodd taught me that in 2004. Wow. And I was so moved by that. And I thought, you know, that's exactly right. And then, you know, later in the show, she does allow herself to be vulnerable and she goes back and actually winds up marrying him. And I think, David, that we've got to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, which is incredibly scary, allow ourselves to experience hurt, so that we can move forward by living life fully. And I'm sure that's what Chip talked about. And we have to do that with people around us that are willing to engage and do the same things. And I think that's incredibly hard to build.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you and I were talking briefly earlier, and we were talking about what a medicated culture we are. I mean, you're laughing as you sip your water here. For those of us that can't see you right now, and it's like that's the understatement of the century, probably. But, you know, I had a friend that lost a loved one recently, and some housewives from a nearby county that's a wealthy county in Tennessee came and she said, you know, she said, where I grew up, people brought a casserole. They brought, you know, their favorite meatloaf. They brought you some lasagna, a cake, of course. Everybody got a chocolate cake when somebody died. And she said, I had these housewives from this county bringing me, I don't know if you have any of this, but, you know, just as little Xanax will help you just, you know, my doctor gives me this Valium. This is not wrong for me to give you this because I get it from a prescription. So this is okay. And in their minds, this is really fine that they're going to all share, you know. And so she said, I have 5 prescriptions that I didn't accept, but I had access to 5 prescriptions that people were, where's the casserole? So if we're living in that kind of, you know, where this is okay to us, mainstream us, you know, what do we do?
It's so right, first of all. The answer to this is actually 100 years old this year. In 1919, Franz Kafka had a quote that I use all the time. He said, to write a prescription is easy. To come to an understanding with a patient is difficult.
Mm.
So you come into my office, David, and you're middle-aged and you're having trouble sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easy thing for me to do. I've been inundated with commercials and direct-to-consumer advertising in the pharmaceutical industry, and I've seen the butterfly from the insomnia medication mm-hmm. that I refuse to give credit to right now. But we all know the commercial, and so I've seen that commercial, and my patients seen that commercial. So the easy thing for me to do is write drug X, 10 milligrams, number 30, 1 POQHS, which means by mouth at bedtime, with 5 refills, and I'll see you again, and you'll be out of my office in under 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The hard thing for me to do is go, hey, David, what's going on in your life, buddy?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what's happening. And the most frequent thing that I saw as a young doc was housewives, middle-aged housewives who had that same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was conditioned as a doctor to problem X, insomnia, solution Y, pill, right? Mm-hmm. Pharmaceutical industry is inundating me with it all the time with sales representatives coming into my office.
Mm-hmm.
And now they go straight to the consumer and directly market, advertise to them as here's the answer to your problem.
Mm-hmm.
The chocolate cake is a gesture of goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
There are no words when you lose a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a cake, and that is my way of saying that I am here for you.
Right.
I can't do anything about it, but I love you and I support you.
Right.
The Xanax is you don't have to feel this way. We can numb it, and you don't have to experience it. And it goes mm-hmm. back to what I just said about Downton Abbey and Lady Mary and Tom Branson.
Yeah.
if I don't experience that pain, I never get to live in the full enjoyment of the joy that comes out of that relationship. I have cheated myself. How do we answer it? I'm militant, David. I want to wake up one morning and see a big pharma bankrupt. That's my dream.
Yeah.
Because the answer here is not the pill. The answer is to engage in relationship and support one another. That middle-aged housewife that comes into my office, I can write her a prescription and have her out in under 5 minutes. The hard thing for me to do is to look at her and engage her in the process of dealing with the fact that she's middle-aged and her husband doesn't look at her the same way, that her kids are grown and they don't need her in the same way that they used to, and that life is moving on. And how do I help you deal with that?
Yeah.
Recovery helped me become a way better doctor.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, recovery is grief work, too. You know, we're grieving what we think we're losing. We're grieving a lot. I'll speak for myself. I grieved a lot of damage. I grieved losses that losses in my persona. You know, who I thought I was, who I'd worked really hard to be, and now I'm finding out that guy's not really going to have a place at the table anymore. And it is grief work, but we don't know how to grieve very well.
We don't know how to grieve, and so, you know, the Xanax prevents it from having to.
Right.
Right. So you have this feeling that you're not familiar with, because the grieving process is actually ultimately about healing.
Mm-hmm.
So the only reason you would ever grieve would be that you lost something of value. And so I always tell people when they're grieving and they've lost someone, oh, gosh, how lucky you are.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't grieving, that person didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And what a shame that would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with time, you are going to heal. It's never going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we are losing something. But look what we're gaining in return. When I get up in the morning, the guy I see in the mirror, I like him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a whole lot better guy than that guy that was medicated and was the great white shark going through life not experiencing anything, right? And that's what a great white does. It's all about, you know, food and reproduction with no care for anything around him. And I was that guy.
Mm-hmm.
I was outgoing, gregarious, and people liked to be around me, and it was funny. And on the side, in the inside, I was empty, and I was alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I used that persona to keep people away, and now I'm open and vulnerable and allow myself to be hurt. And by doing that, I allow others to be in relationship with me, and they're allowing themselves to be hurt, and they're allowing themselves to engage in meaningful relationship. And, man, that's so much better.
Yeah, and, yeah.
And I've got to point out, I can't tolerate anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see it, it's almost repulsive to me, and it makes me sad. And so I always try to figure out a way to engage. And because if I can't engage, then I don't feel like I'm getting the full experience. And while that old Steve is dead, the Steve that I have now I will be vulnerable, but I'm still going to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I still got to make amends.
Mm-hmm.
I still fall short every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I got to be willing to look at it and do what I need to do to improve moving forward. And that is the beautiful 12-step progress rather than perfection.
Right.
And it's that on a daily basis.
Right, yeah. And it's okay to be sad. Sadness is a feeling that we can accept and embrace, not always happily. but it's okay to be sad. My mom went into hospice care last week, and she's 82, and she won't mind me telling this. She's 82 and has early stage Parkinson's, congestive heart failure, and stage 5 kidney failure. And you don't have to have gone to med school to hear that stacks up to a limited amount of time. And she has declined dialysis treatment. She would prefer the rest of her life that she be in better shape, physically feel better, than to feel lousy for longer, is kind of how she's weighed this out. And but she told me the other day, she said, you know, it's amazing when you finally let go of your mortality, the idea that this is all about how do I keep me living. It frees me up to enjoy whatever is the rest of my life, whatever is going to be the rest of my life, because I'm not consumed every day with how I'm going to stay alive. I've figured that out now, and so I'm past that. You know, and so now I'm talking about how I want to spend what is left of my life. And it took the white elephant out of the room, for one thing, that everybody, you know, does she know how sick she is? You know, I mean, God, does mom realize that she's not got a lot of time? And so the other day, yesterday, I was over at her house for a little while with my sister, and she had my sister holding up dresses, and she wanted to know if this dress would look better or this red one. She said, is it bad taste to get buried in a red dress? I don't know. I wonder if it... Mom, people aren't going to think, you know, it's going to look fine. If you want to be buried in a red dress, we're going to bury you in a red dress. But the point is that when we let go and we can be sad with hope or sad with the joy that we still get to experience each other, there is such a thing as redemptive sadness, maybe. And that's what we're experiencing because Mom's given us permission to talk about this by her accepting it and moving forward. So when I take that kind of that same, I guess, principle, and I apply it to the people that I work with and the people that you work with, you know, it's kind of like, can we all address the fact that if this doesn't change, that somebody's going to die,
yeah.
And so we can do life really differently if we're willing to do these things. You know, and how do we connect people with redemptive sadness, but hope? You know, it's all, I don't know. That's a big question, but it's like this stew of emotions that you and I encounter with people in one sitting. You know.
Well, first of all, I love your mom. I don't know her, but I sat here, and the thing that jumped out at me, she got outside of herself.
Right.
When we're able to get outside of ourselves, David, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what she did.
Yeah.
And by doing so, I mean, look at what's coming out of that. I had a cancer patient, and I'm going to say his name. His name is Gene Augram, and Gene was dying of horrific cancer, and I would round with the residents in the hospital, and we'd go in to see Mr. Augram, and he's got this horrible cancer eating him alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in the room, and he said, hey, Dr. Lloyd, how's your day going? How are your kids? Tell me what's going on in your life. And I walked out of the room feeling better. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how did that just happen?
Yeah.
Because what Gene realized is that life is bigger than him. He
right.
got outside of himself. And this is the weird thing. He lived so much longer than he should have.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually been some research around this.
Mm-hmm.
And what your mom has done is she's gotten outside of herself, and she has let that part of it go and allowed you guys to step in. And that, to me, and I was sitting here as you were telling that story, I was smiling ear to ear because I think that's so beautiful.
Mm.
And I think it does matter that she is concerned about being buried in a red dress.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And so how do we get people to do that? The only way that we can get people to do that is that we become okay with being vulnerable ourselves.
Yeah.
So you and I have, you know, I love I think it's the Gandhi quote, be the change you want to see in the world.
Right, yeah.
And that's what I try to tell myself. I sat here today, and I've told you at least two things that I thought I would take to my grave. And the reason that I told you those is because I learned a long time ago with the help of Chip and some really good people that when I open myself up and I allow myself to be vulnerable, what I'm really doing is I'm allowing somebody else to look at that and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
and engage in relationships. So your listeners, that's what I would like to encourage, because I think that whenever we do that and we allow ourselves to see each other's hurts, shames, disappointments, that we relate and we connect.
Right.
And
yeah.
I'm always amazed by what comes out of that. And as I told you, mm-hmm. I've lived a Forrest Gump-like existence, but I don't really think it's by accident.
Right.
I think it's because I was willing to do those things.
Yeah.
And the more I've been willing to do it, and, you know, being able to connect with people where we are. We're in Williamson County right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the most affluent county in the state of Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And by sharing my story and my own hurts and pains and disappointments, I've connected with moms in this county that have lost their children to overdoses, and now they are involved with making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's unbelievably rewarding, and it's bigger than me.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, before we go, because you're in these strategic positions of being able to kind of see what the leadership in our culture is thinking, the kind of the uphill battles and the good stuff that we've been able to accomplish. Where do you see us taking addiction treatment in the next, I don't know, 5-10 years?
Well, you know, I always, it's kind of a loaded question because everybody gets focused on opioids, right? Because it's the news of the day. And what people don't realize is that this has almost nothing to do with the substance. It just happens to do with the availability of it. Mm-hmm. If I told you that 7 out of every 10 patients that I see on a daily basis don't have a problem with opioids, it's alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol dwarfs opioids. It's not anywhere close. Yet I never open up the newspaper and see, you know, an article on alcohol. And so what I've learned is that it has very little to do with the substance. So where do I see addiction treatment going? I see much the same as what we see right now. I see multiple people keep looking at acute care for a chronic problem. I think it'll take a long time to change. I want to be a part of that change, and I can tell by your heart that you for sure want to be a part of that change, as evidenced by the podcast that we're doing. But I think that we eventually reach a tipping point, and I think that as we have more people advocate and become a voice for those who think they don't have a voice, that we will move in the direction where the ultimate solution is, and that ultimate solution is going to be community. Mm-hmm. And it is going to be a relationship. And that relationship actually may be facilitated by medicine to hold cravings at bay. Mm-hmm. It may be. Mm-hmm. And we will become more and more open to being okay with whatever path is right for that person who's struggling. And I think that that'll happen. I see it happening. I always feel blessed to be in Middle Tennessee because we have so many great recovery supportive groups.
Right.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And those of you that live in Middle Tennessee or listening, you need to put that on your gratitude list. Mm-hmm. Because when you start talking about going into rural counties and where I'm from in rural East Tennessee, they don't have that. Mm-hmm. And we have such an abundance of resources, and I think it's really inherent upon us to start to spread that. And as bad as I hate to say this, particularly in light of the conversation we had before we just started, I'm hopeful about technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a way to actually use connectivity, because everybody owns a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are some smart people out there that are going to eventually figure out how to connect us in a meaningful way with some of the applications, social media applications.
Yeah.
Because I think that has great potential to reach people who are isolated otherwise. So the long and short of it is, David, I see us moving in that direction. I see the faith-based community mobilizing. It's the largest untapped resource that we have, and I really see a movement happening there because so many families are effective.
Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind, none of this will happen as long as the shroud of stigma is as thick as it is right now.
Right.
So I think it'll be a process, but that process over time, I think, will happen, and I'm incredibly hopeful for it. I told my wife, at the end of my life, I want my obituary to read that I was a guy in long-term recovery. And in lieu of flowers, please donate money to the National Institute for Drug Abuse, or please donate money to the next door.
Mm-hmm.
And when I start to see that in obituaries, then I'll know.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's a great hope, and great place to wrap up. Dr. Stephen Lloyd, thank you so much for coming today and being a part of our podcast, a part of the positive sobriety that we're hoping to get people to enjoy in this life that you and I get to enjoy too. So,
thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. And here we are, Nate, after a really good conversation with Dr. Lloyd. What are some of your takeaways from some of the things you heard there? Did you?
Yeah. First of all, I really appreciate his vulnerability and the compassion he has for those addicts who face the whole challenge of recovery without all the advantages that he had.
Right.
And I really was, I've had it. I've been very, very fortunate to live in the part of the country where I live, to have fallen into the associations that I fell into. I've gotten great help from great people.
Right.
And I'm sure that we've got listeners out there who don't have these advantages. And my great hope is that this podcast will be a door toward other options and opportunities for our...
Right. I was encouraged that, like you say, and you know, Nashville's a great place to get recovery.
It sure is, man.
You know, there's all kinds of resources here, and it's a medical town as much as a entertainment hub, and a lot of resources here for recovery. But if you live in a place where there isn't maybe the same kind of opportunity that we had, like you said, the thing I loved that Stephen really harped about was connection.
Yeah.
And you don't have to live in Nashville, Tennessee in order to avail yourself to connection. We have to admit that we need it. We have to bravely go into those situations because none of us want to, you know, be vulnerable, but it was a really powerful thing to hear him say, regardless of the opportunities, connection.
It's all about connection. Yeah. And because we live in an increasingly connected world, even if you cannot connect physically with somebody within a 3-mile radius of your house, like you and I can, I've got dozens of people within a 3-mile radius of my house. If you're listening to the podcast, that tells me you have the capacity for some technological connection, which means you have you can connect with the rest of the world, and there is a big recovery subculture out there, a recovery universe out there.
There is online and virtual groups.
Right.
I have a number of people that work in entertainment, and they travel constantly.
Yeah.
And one of the things they've discovered, and actually, one of my clients prefers is his virtual group.
Oh yeah,
because he said, "I've got a screen name. No one knows me as Joe Entertainer person. But secondly, I can log in, check in with these people anytime. And he said I can be on my bus at 2 a.m. and log on, and somebody's there.
Yeah."
Can't sleep. We have a conversation, and it may not be, you know, the most inspiring thing in the world, but neither one of us drank.
Right. There you go.
And or used or did X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there are tons of opportunities.
Yeah, I'll be heading back to the house as soon as we wrap here so that I can log on in my office at noon on Thursday Central Time to a virtual Samson meeting with guys from those guys are from around the world, actually.
Right.
Yeah. Who are becoming some of my closest friends. And we'll laugh and we'll tell the truth. And there might be a moment where we come close to tears. That happens occasionally.
Yeah.
I'm moved by the sacredness of vulnerability and honesty. That's what really gets to me these days.
Right.
Right?
Right. And I have a... someone that I have started seeing who started coming to me through a virtual group.
Yeah.
Because someone thought maybe they needed more than just the virtual experience. But yes, I mean, these things are not to be minimized. They're not gaming sites here.
Right,
these are real people on the other end that care about one another.
And I really loved as well the way Stephen talked about, you know, being taught, he learned from Chip how to kind of go with the flow of life and to drop his unrealistic expectations about how life always going to be a party and a parade, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or as, that classic book, The Road Less Traveled, you know, begins at just telling opening line that I absolutely love. Life is difficult.
Exactly.
You know, a truth which, once accepted, somehow makes life easier.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, wow, what a great time. And I'm looking forward to getting back on regular schedule. We're talking with some great guests coming on.
Yeah, we have some, and we're gonna make an appearance on some other people's podcasts, and we'll let you know about those coming up as well.
Sure. Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess this about wraps it for this long-awaited episode. It'd be good to get it up. And by the way, our thanks again to Rex, our inimitable and unbelievably skilled and dedicated and helpful.
Oh yeah.
Executive producer / engineer / genius who makes this all happen. We have the easy part. We just
yes, we do. This right? would be two monkeys and a soundboard right now. We didn't have Rex. So.
So Rex Paul Schnelli, thank you, man. Yeah. So, all right. Well, until next week. I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.